This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Today on Flashpoints, we have a New Year's special focusing on the 209th anniversary of the independence of the nation of Haiti. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Welcome back. And today is the 209th anniversary of the independence of the nation of Haiti. So I'm going to devote the entire hour today to Haiti and all things Haitian, something that I happen to know a little bit about, having lived there for seven years, from 1999 to 2006, during a very difficult period of that country's history. To begin today, though, I'd like to introduce and bring in a dear friend of mine and a good friend of the show. He's been on often, and that's Ira Kurzban. Ira Kurzban served as the legal counsel for the government of Haiti for over a decade, spanning two administrations, the administration of Jean-Bertrand Aristide and René Garcia Préval. In addition to that, he is also one of the foremost immigration law experts in the country. He's written a book that is widely used by judges and lawyers throughout the United States. So before we get to Haiti, first of all, let me welcome you on to Flashpoints. Welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, Ira Kurzban.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and a Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Happy New Year to you, too, and thank you so much for joining us today. I did this at short notice, so I'm really, really happy that you could join us. Listen, I know that we're going to talk a little bit about Haiti in a bit, but I wanted to start, since you are one of the foremost experts on immigration law in the United States, I want to sort of get an accounting of you of where immigration reform stands today. It not only affects, of course, Haitians, many Haitians who've been tied up in the legal system for years, many of them who don't know their status, and many of them who can't get out of illegal status or are stuck in limbo, having applied but never having had a hearing date. Of course, that affects immigrants from all over the world. Where do you see immigration reform law today in this country?
Well, I think the election was a defining moment in obtaining comprehensive immigration reform. I think the Republican Party finally woke up and recognized that I think now there has to be immigration reform. Their idea expressed through Romney of self-deportation resulted in the largest Hispanic turnout for a Democratic candidate, I think, ever. Even here in South Florida, which has traditionally been Republican because there are Cubans here, there were polls indicating that Obama won either the majority or close to the majority of Cuban votes, which is absolutely unheard of. I mean, for a presidential candidate like Bill Clinton, for example, I think he got about 20 or 25% of the Cuban vote, in the election when he won Florida. But to win that high a number was just unprecedented, and it's a reflection on the Republican Party's position on immigration. So I think now they have woken up. We have, for the first time, for example, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, political action committee sponsored by conservative Republicans. I began a few years ago something called Immigrants List, the first pro-immigration political action committee. Most political action committees were by conservative Republicans that were anti-immigration. For the first time now, you have people pouring millions of dollars into pro-immigration on the conservative Republican side. So I think it's, you know, clearly a sign that we're going to have comprehensive immigration reform. And when, you know, clients come to my office, I tell them, no, I really believe that we will have a new law this year. You know, some people call it an amnesty, some people call it a pathway to residency and then to citizenship. But whatever it's going to be, it's going to address, among other things, the approximately 11 million people who are not considered to be documented in the U.S. There are also a lot of other issues, and one of the things that we have always been concerned with in Immigrants List, the PAC that I mentioned is that we don't want to trade off a law that's going to make these people residents and then have another terrible law like the 1996 immigration law we had. So we're working on issues to modify some of the harshest provisions of the 96 law and to move in a much more progressive direction in regard to immigration, not only in terms of giving people a status, but in also ending things like mandatory detention, which costs the American people almost $1 billion a year. I'm sure your listeners, for example, do not know that immigration has become the largest jailer in America, larger than the Bureau of Prisons, larger than any state prison. We now hold about 400,000 immigrants a year in detention. It's become a little mini kind of military-industrial complex, you know, a mini jail city complex, where you have private prisons and cities now lobbying.
Right, I was going to say, it's also been privatized and it's become a point of profit for some companies.
Yeah, no, it's a huge profit, and if you're talking about almost $1 billion a year, and the Congress has even mandated that they have to fill somewhere around 33,000 beds a month. So one of the things we're trying to do is get rid of that mandate, have a sensible approach where, you know, they may keep people who are very high risk in detention, but end this mandatory detention policy that says we're going to keep you in detention even if you're not a threat to society or even if you're not likely to abscond. And that's the situation we have right now. So we're looking at that issue, a whole bunch of other issues, but I think there will be what they call comprehensive immigration reform in 2013.
And that is the voice of my guest, Ira Kurzban. Ira is one of the foremost immigration attorneys in the United States. He's written a book. The name of the book, again, is Kurzban's
Immigration Law
Sourcebook. Kurzban's Immigration Law Sourcebook. It is widely used by judges and immigration attorneys throughout the United States. We are discussing immigration reform in the United States. We're going to also discuss Haiti a little bit later. Well, it's interesting, this part about how elements of immigration, incarceration of what they call illegals, what they deem people illegal. Of course, I don't use that term myself, but who the system deems as being here illegal, and how this has become such a profit-driven industry. Isn't that now part of the problem? That indeed, because there is so much money at stake, that it might make it more difficult to pass comprehensive immigration reform?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, just like you had the three strikes law, you know, being pushed by, you know, people who own the prison system and people who were involved in the prison system in one way or another in California, you have that now nationally. You have private companies like Corrections Corporation of America, the guards, the private guards who serve in some of these places who have their own companies, lobbying Congress to make sure that we continue to have mandatory detention of people who pose no threat to us. You know, there are lots of ways in which you can track people. You can even have electronic monitoring or ankle bracelets or reporting or other forms of keeping track of people without keeping them incarcerated, because keeping them in jail means a number of things. You know, the first thing it means, clearly, is that the taxpayers of the United States are spending a fortune of money that's unnecessary because there are other ways to track people. Secondly, it separates families. And, you know, we're not talking about somebody who came across the border last week to do some illegal drug deal. We're talking about lawful permanent residents who may have had a conviction in 1998 for something, you know, 12 years ago, or even many, many years ago, even before that, who are now subject potentially to mandatory detention. I've had clients, for example, had a conviction 25 years ago. They went out of the country. When they come back in, they are treated as if they were a first-time entry and kept in detention. Now, these are people often who have families, you
jobs,
know,
right.
Spouses, jobs. Some of them actually are, you know, so-called job creators. They're people who actually have companies and employ other American citizens and so forth. So this law was overly harsh in 96, and it led to a lot of these kinds of consequences. And so one of the things we're fighting is how to end this mandatory detention. A second thing, just be brief on this, is in 1996, we created a provision of the law, which the Republicans rammed through. Nobody even understood it. The president signed the law, unfortunately, Clinton. And the provision says if you're in the United States illegally, that is if you come into the United States legally, but you stay 6 months longer than you were allowed to, and you leave, you can't come back for 3 years. If you stay a year longer and you leave, you can't come back for 10 years. Now, for many, many years in the United States, you were able to make those people residents of the United States. If they had a family member or if an employer wanted to right. petition for them and so forth, their only penalty was they had to leave the country to get their residency. Well, those people can't leave now because then they can't come back for 10 years. So this, what we call the 10-year bar, has had incredible untoward consequences. Of those 11 million so-called undocumented people, half of them are in that situation. That half could have become residents under the old law. So the Republicans actually created a law which did exactly what they were trying to prevent. That is, it trapped people in the United States by saying that if you leave, you can't come back for 10 years, and if you leave, even if you could become a resident, you'd still have to wait outside the country for 10 years. The 3 and 10-year bar is something else that has to go, and we're looking at that in comprehensive immigration reform.
Wow, and again, that is the voice of my guest, Ira Kurzban. Ira is one of the foremost immigration attorneys in the United States. And as I said earlier, today we're also going to devote a good part of our program to today being the 209th anniversary of the independence of Haiti, Haiti becoming the world's first black republic in the world, second only to the United States in the hemisphere. Ira, also, you know, you also served for 10 years as a legal counsel to the Haitian government, spanning two administrations. One of them, of course, was for Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who I understand you currently represent legally in the United States. You represent his affairs in this country. And I know that there's been a lot of talk recently, turning our attention back to Haiti, that there have been these complaints that have been filed against him. And it seems to be yet another chapter, if you will, in the continuing attempt to assassinate Jean-Bertrand Aristide's character. There was, of course, before that, this scandal that involved the telecommunications company Teleco, the state-run telecommunications company inside of Haiti, where they claimed that Aristide was unnamed, but may have been one of the people that were named in this indictment, and that that had proved somehow that he was involved in corruption. The Miami Herald famously printed it, and we understand that there was never any corroboration that indeed Aristide was the identified person within that indictment. But then also what happened is that in the next beat, somebody else who had worked for Aristide was then assassinated in Haiti, and the Miami Herald somehow implied that he was involved in that assassination. And now we have former kids of his former orphanage who I understand now are filing a lawsuit against him in Haiti, claiming that he had abused them, that he had used them in order to enrich himself. And then we have another group of the members of the Victims of Cooperatives, or CONUSOVIC, who were, there was a cooperative scheme inside of Haiti that they claim that Aristide was part of. I was there. I didn't see it. I got my own point of view, but I want to hear yours first. Anyway, the point is that there is this parade of attacks against Aristide's character that seem to be continuing. Can you give us a little bit of insight about what you know or what your feelings are about this?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a short story. I was talking to a friend of mine, a Frenchman, and he said, you know, there's a famous French colloquial expression that says, if you want to kill a dog, describe him as being rabid. It makes it a lot easier to do it. And, you know, this is the history of the United States, France, and the right wing, you know, the wealthy right wing in Haiti in regard to President Aristide. They have continued to lead since 1989 a disinformation campaign. You've mentioned some of it, of course, since 1989. I mean, they have accused President Aristide of virtually everything. I mean, from drug dealing, human rights violations, being mentally ill, you know, now suggesting that somehow he was a child molester. And this goes back to what my French friend said. I mean, you know, the more you can describe him, whether true or not, and in this case, none of this is true, and I can obviously talk about that in great detail, it makes it easier to try and either eliminate him physically or at least prevent him from doing what he does best, which is to unite the Haitian people. You know, the U.S. government, the French government, the Canadian government, all of whom were directly involved in the second coup against President Aristide, and the U.S. government, along with the Haitian military, involved in the first coup against President Aristide, they have a vested interest in keeping the Haitian people divided, poor, in the same situation that we've seen over the last 20 years. And I think this is, you know, ultimately the problem, that right now there's a potential new election in Haiti that will be coming up soon. They know that if President Aristide is in any way allowed to participate, either through the Lavalas Party, or if he were to run for election, they know that the Lavalas Party would win overwhelmingly in Haiti, and they also know that if President Aristide ran for re-election, which he has said repeatedly he has no interest in doing, and I believe he has none, but he would easily win. When you look at the numbers, they're really astounding. Aristide won the first election by 67% of the vote with 17 candidates. He won the second election by over 90% of the vote. His Lavalas Party won 70 to 75% of all the seats in the legislature in 2000 in a full and fair election. And since then, they have really, in effect, banned the Lavalas Party. They've used every means possible to prevent it from participating in the elections. And they have obviously engaged in a coup against President Aristide in 2004 to make sure that he could not remain in the country. My firm belief is that the strategy of the U.S. intelligence community and the French and the Canadians was to remove Aristide. The French took him to the Central African Republic, where I believe they were going to kill him. You'll note this week that the